Добро пожаловать на подкаст классической камеры.
Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
Comrades, welcome to the May episode of Classic Camera Revival, and today we are going a little bit back in time to this interesting period of the world's history known as the Cold War, and talking about various cameras that came from communist-based nations, mostly out of the USSR or the United Soviet Socialist Republics. That's correct? Now, I was back... Now, I was in Ottawa back at the beginning of March, and one of the places a group of us history nerds visited was the National War Museum in Ottawa, Ontario, and one of the items there is a piece of the old Berlin Wall. Now, the Berlin Wall was a barrier between East and West Berlin that came down in the 80s. 89. And with it, the rest of the proverbial Iron Curtain fell, and all of a sudden, we here in the West gained access slowly to a whole bunch of interesting little cameras. And now, a lot of these cameras, if you see them at a camera show or in the hands of a person, you'll probably think, oh, look, that's a Contax, or oh, look, that's a Leica. And the simple fact is that these were based on these German cameras, because during the Second World War, when Russia overran the country, they took with them a whole pile of camera technology, engineers, manufacturing, and machines. So we're going to have a lively discussion about some of these rare Russian gems that are now available to us and are still actually pretty decent cameras that you can find at decent prices.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about a couple of cameras. The first is the 35mm rangefinder known as the Kiev. And the Kiev has been described as a German camera built in Russia because at the end of the Second World War, as some war booty, the Russians got a hold of the factory where the Contax cameras were built and basically picked up all the dies, the manufacturing equipment, as well as a whole whack of parts and carted them off to the Ukraine to start building cameras. Now, the Contax camera, like people talk these days about the, you know, Nikon versus Canon war. Back then, in the 30s and 40s, the photographic arms race was between Contax and Leica. And there are those who will say that for a period of time, that the Contax camera was technologically superior. It had a bayonet lens mount as opposed to the screw mount. The rangefinder and the viewfinder were coupled so that you only had one window to look through, whereas in the screw mount Leicas, you had one separate viewfinder for focusing and the other for composing. And as well, it has a very, very wide rangefinder base to allow for very, very precise focusing. It has a wider rangefinder base than the Leica of the time. But then what happened with Contax, and I guess sort of like in the 50s, when the Leica M series came out, Contax sort of got left behind because Leica had leapfrogged their technology. But enough about Contax, time to talk about the Kiev. So the very first Kiev cameras are actually made from German parts that were just brought home. In fact, there are some, air quotes, Kiev cameras that are actually labeled as Contax. And these are the ones, like these are rare and these are highly sought after by collectors. But then they started making ones that were labeled Kiev. The model that I have here is this is the Kiev 3, and it's made in the late 1950s. And the lens that I have on it is the Jupiter 12, which is a 35mm lens. The reason why I had to buy a Kiev body is I bought this Jupiter 12 lens, but then I read that it would not fit, or that it would not work properly on my Contax 3A. So I just, you know, with tears in my eyes, I had to go online and say, well, I'm going to buy a Kiev to go with the Contax, because it's an amazing lens, very, very sharp, but you do have to use it on a Kiev. The Kiev, it's a beautiful body. It's solid. The difference between, like, you'll see twos and threes, some of them have these really ugly selenium lens meters or light meters up top, and 99.9% of the time, the meter is broken. The rest of the time, it's a working, horrible, useless selenium-based light meter. So if you buy one of these and the light meter doesn't work, treat it as a non-metering camera and use Sunny 16 or an iPhone or a light meter or whatever. One thing about the quality control on the Kiev cameras, and as we go through this episode, I think there'll be a few references to quality control. But let me be the first to say that a lot of the Soviet Russian gear was very, very well engineered, very, very well designed, but the quality control and the manufacturing was sometimes a bit iffy. And especially as time went on, if you're going to buy one of these Kiev cameras, if you can buy one that was made in the 50s or the early 60s, the older, the better. They did make Kiev Contax knockoffs up into, I think, even into the 80s, but the ones in the 80s are horrible. In fact, there is a story. I've not been able to independently verify it, but there were some that are so bad that they were basically trucked straight from the factory to the dump. They knew that they were not working. And in fact, what people would do in the Soviet Union, they would buy one of these cameras and they would then take it to a repairman to say, here's my camera, can you finish it? So they would buy the camera knowing that it would not work. They would get a repair person to say, okay, make it a working camera. And once that was done, it was a good camera. And like these are, you know, you can get the bodies for under $100. Or better, around $100. But I think with any Russian gear, you have to go into it knowing that your hit rate is not going to be 100%. If you get 75% hit rate, you are fortunate.
If you want to learn how to fix cameras, buy a Russian one.
I'm going to mention one more camera, and this beast is a Zenit 3M, single lens reflex. And what's interesting about the Zenit 3M, this one dates from the 1960s, is that it has a 39 millimeter screw mount, same as the Leica screw mount. But because the distance from the lens flange to the film is different, the only way you can use a Leica lens on this is if you want to do close-up work, because it acts as an extension tube. And the reason I have this camera is so that I can use, this is one of my Helios 44-2 lenses, which is just gorgeous, but this is the only camera I can use it on. And this is actually my third copy of the body. I broke the shutter on the first one, because the one thing with a lot of these Russian cameras is that you can't change the shutter speed, then cock the shutter. It'll break.
You'll cock it up.
Oh, ba-doom, boom. And I thought I had done it, and I didn't on this one, and it broke. I ordered another one. It came, and it wasn't even in working condition when I got it. Oh. So I got this one, and this one is really nice, and I like the Cyrillic lettering. It's the most attractive. So, absolutely. You know, you can get a combination of one of these bodies and a Helios 44-2 lens for $100 or a bit under, and it makes for a beautiful, beautiful portrait kit. This is my go-to kit now for portrait cameras. It's that good.
Okay, so Mike, what sort of red gold do you have for us today?
Okay, I really wouldn't say for my first camera would be gold. I've got the Lubitel 2.
I had one of those.
And honestly, the lenses, the Lomo lenses, they're really, really lovely lenses on them. My only problem is this is based off a Voigtlander Brilliant early copy. And I remember Leslie Lazenby was talking about her wonderful box cameras, or let me rephrase that, her Brownie or her Duaflex. And when you look through the viewfinder, everything's in focus and it's very, very clean and clear. And it's basically look for the pretty picture and take it. Well, this camera here, it actually focuses, but the type of viewfinder you've got is basically exactly like Leslie was talking about. Look for the pretty picture and take it. Dead center of the view screen is a teeny tiny little dot that is used for focusing. It's atrocious. I can't stand using it. But aside from that, if you use your little close-up diopter to do your focusing, fantastic. You get some half-decent swirl out of the lens. And it is relatively sharp, as some of the photos that will pop up in the show notes will show you. But honestly, I don't like the focusing screen on this thing. And maybe one day I'll be able to change it out. But for now, no. No, definitely not.
Oh, no, I can totally agree. One of my my first experience with Soviet cameras was a Lubitel 2. It was also my first experience working with a twin-lens camera. And I can agree the focusing is atrocious, but one interesting thing about these Lomo cameras is that the lenses are glass. I mean, this is not a plastic-lensed camera. It actually has really good optics, super sharp in the... super sharp in the middle, and really decent fall off on the edges.
Yeah, and the other thing that I really like about it is it's a really, really inexpensive way to get into medium format. And most times, I haven't heard of one, this being happening on one, is the shutter actually is half decent. I haven't heard of one that doesn't work.
Yeah, one thing you just have to remember is that the focusing is in meters, not feet.
Yes, and if you happen to look on your focusing wheel, you'll actually get a really good laugh because you'd think you're looking at f-stops. It starts at 1.4 meters and goes to 11 meters, with every single mark being an f-stop. It's actually pretty humorous. So that's the Lubitel 2. I mean, if you really enjoy your Lubitel 2, all the power to you. I've used it, and when you use the close-up fine focusing, it's not bad, but at least it makes it easy to compose because the screen on it is super bright. Now, the next one is a friend of mine's favorite. Dan Ebert's camera that he's been looking to hear about is the Fed 2. This camera is, it's a Leica copy, and honestly, this is probably one of my favorite cameras. I mean, I actually chose it well over a Leica. It's easier to load. It fits easier in my hand. The viewfinder, rangefinder is one window, and I don't have to squint or pray that I'm looking through it. And it just, I'm not scared of dropping it, because if I do, oh well, I buy another. In all honesty, sure, it doesn't have the slow speeds of the Leica from 1/20th to a second. It doesn't also have 1/1000th of a second, but honestly, I never shoot really above 1/250th, and I never really shoot beyond below 1/25th. Viewfinder, rangefinder is very bright. I don't have to worry about mounting my Jupiter 8 to it and not having focus, or having focus problems with it. And I don't have to sit there and swear and curse for half a decade while I sit there and try to load a roll of 35 millimeter and realize, oh great, I forgot to cut the leader properly and now it won't load.
So the back actually flips open like a regular camera. It's not a bottom loader like the old Leica 3s.
Actually, no. The nice thing about this, and I really...
the whole back slides off.
Yeah, yes. I really pray that I did not load this with film. I don't think I did.
Does it have film in it?
No, it doesn't. No. I didn't totally F this
because
off.
We don't hear Mike crying right now.
But, no, I mean...
not that roll of APX 25.
Yes, that had the pictures of Elvis on it.
So, anyway... the nice thing about this is really, really simple to load. The 35 millimeter take-up spool comes off to make it easier to load. Or you can't. Okay. I'm thinking of the Exacta. We'll talk about that another time. It's fantastic. My model had a couple minor pinholes in the shutter, which is very common on these. Although one of the more common things is the the shutter actually lets more light through it when it's closed than when it's open.
I had a Zorky 4 that had quite a bit of a pinholing in it.
Yeah. Now, the nice thing about this is it was a really simple fix. Sharpie marker, done. Believe nice. It or not, a Sharpie marker worked perfect. And I have never had a single pinhole problem since, so far. I did have a minor issue with the Indistar 26M lens that I had. It had a little bit of swirl on the back element, and well, they're basically just cleaning marks or small scratches. Front element scratches, not too big a deal. Rear element, major problem. It's massive reflection, and I'll link a couple of the photos that I took using it to show you the problem with it after I got a new model of the 26M. Instant problem solved. Now I use my Jupiter 8, which is a 50mm f2. John gave me a 50mm Indistar 22, which is an Elmar copy. Plus, I also have another i26M, and I have an Indistar 61. The 61 is just, it is so sharp. It just blows my mind. I used it on the Leica before I traded it away, and it was just phenomenal. So how's that for a Russian lens? It is just awesome.
One thing we should mention about the Russian lenses is quite often let's say they get a Leica, and lesson number one of Leica, the Leica screw mount lenses tend to be rather expensive. Especially if you want, let's say, a Sumitar or something like that, or Summicron, you are spending major coin. So I figure, well, I'll try a Russian lens. And they get a Russian lens, and they're disappointed with the sharpness. And the issue is that while the Russian lens technically will screw into a Leica body, the what's called the registration of the collimation is not quite the same. Right. And again, because the manufacturing tolerances in Russian lenses are a bit
lax.
A bit lax, yes. So your mileage can vary. But quite often, you will not get the degree of sharpness you're looking for when you mount a Russian lens to a Leica body, especially if you're shooting a fairly fast lens like a Jupiter 8 f2, or you're focusing close up. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes people, the Russian lenses would get a bad rap because of that. But if you mount them on the Russian camera, then the problem goes away. And if you get a good one, because again, buy three lenses and hope that two of them work. The Jupiter 8 is an amazing lens. The Indistar was 60, what is it, 62?
61.
The 61 is painfully sharp lens. There are really a lot of amazingly good Russian lenses. You mount them on the proper camera and you'll be shocked at just how good they are.
Mm. Well, the 61N, or I should, yeah, the 61N I have, the one model I have is I believe mine is actually mislabeled because I do have the lanthanum coating, which can be really seen for the fact that you look through it and the lens is pretty yellow. I don't feel like putting it into a UV treatment. I just leave it. It actually worked on the Leica 3A that I did have for a while, and it was phenomenally sharp. I'll link an image, although yes, it's taken on a Leica and it's our red month. But the fact of the matter, it was taken through a Russian lens and it is amazing. I love this photo. I'm planning on giving it a nice big print. And my quick little view on the Fed 2, brilliant camera. Every single photographer out there that uses a rangefinder, even if you don't want to keep it, get your hands on one, try it out. You'll probably end up keeping it, but As John was mentioning, yes, definitely keep in mind that the first copy may not be the best copy. The hit-miss rate, sadly, is pretty high. Thankfully, I got lucky when I got mine.
Okay, so the other famous communist country in the world, not Cuba, is China. So we have another twin-lens reflex camera here, and Donna, take it away.
Okay, so I have the Seagull 4A103. It was made in 1991, and believe it or not, it is still made as a 4A109. It is a 120 film TLR camera with a twin lens reflex. The upper lens is used to compose the photo, and the lower one accommodates the shutter and aperture, as it is used to take the photo. Now, one of the things I like about the Seagull is the impression you get when you are looking through the viewfinder. It is like having the already finished photo on the screen, because the image is projected onto the ground glass, making it look like the picture you are going to take. The Seagull is a fully manual camera. For those of you that don't mind that, then this camera is a camera for you. It looks great and is much cheaper than a Rollycord or a Yashica, and it has a similar look. The viewfinder is super clear, especially for people with glasses. It is super easy to use. Overall, it's a great camera and gives fantastic images, easy to load. It is a little bit on the heavier side, though, if you are planning on going on long walks, but it is a fantastic little camera. It does have a hot shoe, yes. Yes, it does.
And what would one of those cost, approximately, on the used market?
Used market, you're probably looking at
about
100. Sometimes okay. The later models of 4A109, okay. They really, really get up there in price. I have seen them in the vicinity of getting up to around $400 to $500.
The viewfinder on this is much better than the Lubitel.
Oh, yeah.
For those of you that are wondering.
Now, those that are curious, I had purchased the Lubitel 2 for the sole purpose of Donna not wanting to let go of my Rollycord. I thought, oh, gee, I'll get her a little Lubitel 2 and she'll finally leave my Rollycord alone.
No.
Yeah, no, not at all. All that happened was she really likes the look of the Lubitel 2, but there's no way she's ever giving up my Rollycord. So then I happened to get my hands on the Seagull and I thought, okay, maybe she'll leave my Rollycord alone. No, strange thing happened. Now she claims that she has a Lubitel 2, a Rollycord, and a Seagull. How nice. I seem to be losing the cameras.
One common theme for all the brands of the Russian cameras and the Chinese cameras we're talking about is you are not going to go broke checking out this kind of photography.
No.
Even given the fact that quite often you'll have to buy, you know, one or two copies of something to get something that that works, is, you know, let's face it, photography can be a very expensive hobby, especially, let's say, if you're into Leicas and Rolleiflexes. This is a way to indulge your gas and still be able to put food on the table.
Always a plus in filming the camera.
Yeah, exactly.
But it wasn't just German camera that the Russians copied. They also copied a very famous Swedish camera called the Hasselblad. Again, coming out of the Kiev factory in the Ukraine, the Kiev 88. It is an absolutely brilliant 6x6 medium format SLR, very similar to the Hasselblad. And a lot of times you can actually take early Hasselblad accessories and mount them onto the Kiev or vice versa. I know that the Kiev TTL right angle viewfinder will fit on the Hasselblad 500 series quite easily. And I had a Kiev 88 for a while, a couple of film backs. I had to do some minor repairs to get the film counters fixed. But again, it was just adjusting a screw here and there. And I mean, unfortunately, I really feel bad that I ended up selling the camera, but I did it to fund buying another lens. And I mean, at the time, the camera was, it performed surprisingly well. I had two lenses for it, both excellent. And the camera worked really, really well. And when you were shooting at a fairly shallow depth of field, the out of focus elements were dead on. I really only shot it a handful of times because I really don't like that style of camera. It doesn't really sit well in my hand. It worked better on a tripod. So the photos I've included are actually from an abandoned tuberculosis hospital up in Gravenhurst.
Oh, thank you.
But yeah, but it wasn't just camera gear that the Russians brought back with them from Germany. They also brought back film technology. Now, of course, with the Soviets, they didn't want anything really from the West to come into their country. So they had several film manufacturers, and probably one of the most famous ones, the Kodak of the Soviet bloc, was Svema. Now, the name Svema comes from a handful of letters from the first word and the second word in Ukrainian that comes from photosensitive materials. So that's exactly it. The Svema company originally started off just producing black and white film and paper,
But again, when they overran Germany, they brought back color technology from the Agfa plant. Now, the neat thing is that this film is still produced today from a top secret location in the Ukraine. So, world leaders, if you're listening, please settle things up with the Ukraine so that Svema Film can still keep coming here to North America.
It's all about priorities.
And probably the major, the only really source of Svema Film in North America is from our good friends down in New Jersey at the Film Photography Project. And it is an absolutely incredible, incredible line of film. Everything from super slow 0.75 ASA film all the way up to 400 speed film. So, John, what sort of experience have you had with the Svema film?
I'd say the Svema film is absolutely fantastic. I remember first reading about it. I think Leslie Lazenby on FPP was just saying how it had reignited her passion for black and white. Mm-hmm. So
especially
the
200 speed stuff.
Yeah, that's the stuff that I started with, and it is absolutely incredible. It has a sharpness, a glow. And one thing I like, there's sort of a good news, bad news. It's on a like the polyester base.
The 200 is, yeah.
The 200. And so it dries super, super flat. Mm-hmm. So if you are scanning it, like quite often if you're scanning negatives, films I find like Tri-X takes a pronounced curl, and it's a real SOB to flatten for scanning. You basically have to, you know, I have to reverse roll the film and let it sit for 24 hours before I can even scan it. The Svema Photo 200, it dries very, very quickly, like normally within an hour and a half or 2 hours, and it dries super, super flat, and it scans great. But now the downside is that on certain kind of developing reels, like the Pattersons, yeah, it can be a bit tricky to load the polyester-based film. I use the steel reels, but even there, it has its own kind of feel. But still, it's an absolute, is one of my favorite black and white emulsions. And I also want to mention the C41, the 125. This film is, it has a unique look. It would not be my everyday film, but if you want a nice, dreamy, vintagey, pastel look,
yeah,
this stuff is incredible.
It definitely runs a unique color palette. It's definitely something different than what you'd see out of the Japanese Fuji and the American Kodak.
Well, speaking of that Svema 125 color film, I put a roll of that through my little Ricoh Mirai 135. It's just a little, it's not really little. It's pretty big, hefty, plastic.
It's Batman's camera.
Pretty much. The Batman camera was the 105. But this is basically the exact same thing. And the optics, I'm not going to go into the camera, but the optics are really amazing. But the images I have on this film, they completely, totally floored me. I was just so blown away with this film. I got to the point when I'm looking at it and I was practically drooling over the color, the sharpness, the super fine grain I'm getting out of it. I'm going to link one of my favorite photos that I took on this. It is just stunning. Honestly, John said it wouldn't be his go-to film. I'm almost leaning the other way. This stuff is amazing. I can't wait to get my roll of 120 through it. I'm really, really, really stoked about that one.
Now, one thing we do have to mention about the 125 is that unlike Western color negative films, it doesn't have the same kind of orange background base masking color.
No, it's almost like an orangey pink.
Yeah, and so what happens is if you're scanning it, it will confuse a film scanner, because a film scanner, when you set it to do like the color negative C41, it expects that orange mask to be there, and it corrects for it. And if it's not there, it doesn't correct for it. It tries to, so it just looks a bit funky. Yeah. My little trick is I don't mess too much with the settings in the scanner. What I do, I bring it into Lightroom, and then I tell Lightroom to auto white balance.
Oh, interesting.
And to pretend it's a digital image. So I set white balance to auto, and that normally gets me about 75% of where I need to be in order to correct it.
Fix the rest in something like Photoshop.
Exactly, because trying to get it, you know, depending on the scanner software, it can be a real trick to get a an accurate color rendition.
Absolutely. The other film that I have to mention is the FN64.
Yes.
Holy cow. I went on a photo walk with Alex and Ori and several other people. We just met up in the December from, I can't say hell, because it was so friggin' cold. It's more like hell froze over. And pretty much it literally did. This is just shortly after the ice storm we had here. And I took my T90 out with FN64. First time ever trying it. And I was absolutely just amazed. And when John says about film drying flat, this stuff dries beautifully flat. Just absolutely stunning. The contrast was just such a beautiful curve to it. I mean, we're looking at a slow film, probably in the range of Pan F. It's 64 ISO versus 50, but you don't get the punch in the face contrast that Pan F has. It's a lot smoother, but it is amazingly sharp and pretty much no grain to speak of. The only thing is, because it is a polyester base, the cartridges have to have a slightly thicker felt on it. Otherwise, you'll get what's known as light piping towards the beginning. And that can start to affect 3, 4, 5 frames in. I'm actually really used to it because I've been shooting a lot of polypan. And that stuff, very, very similar. It's thin polyester base and you get light piping through it if you're not careful. And it's one of those things that unfortunately kind of come to expect with polyester films.
One of my favorite emulsions from the Svema line is the MZ3. This is an ASA3 film, highly blue sensitive, so very similar to the Eastman 5363. This film is just incredible. I've taken it out twice. The first time was to Fort Michilimackinac in Mackinac City, Michigan, and the other time I took it up to Wyarton, Ontario. And both times, I mean, I had to shoot it on a tripod because we're talking an ASA3 film here. But it's incredibly sharp, especially if you want to do architectural work. Also would probably be good for copy work as well, being blue sensitive. So it was probably a motion picture film initially for making title slides, etc. The developer I used was HC110. Now since it is such a slow film, you aren't using the dilution A or B. I actually settled on 6 minutes in dilution E, which was a wild guess. I tried it at 6:30 and just blew it way out, so I dropped it another 30 seconds. One of the joys of these films is that we don't have much in the way of developing formulas here, so we're sort of stabbing in the dark with what we know.
Ba-dum-bum.
And it's a great film. If you want to get away from the stuff we're just used to here, like the Ilfords, the Kodaks, the Fujis, the Svema line of film, or there's also the Orwo line of film, which is another Soviet one. You get that online in bulk rolls, and you can get the UN-54, which is a nice 100-speed film.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Or if you want some, if you want real grit, you go with the NP-74. That's a 400-speed stuff. And I shot a roll of that in an abandoned Catholic school in Cincinnati. I'll make sure that there are some photos up on the note.
I got a chance to try out the Svema Blue. This is a blue-sensitive film that is not blue. It's actually yellow. And it has a ISO speed of, I think it's 4. I'm not positive. I shot it at 4. And I love the tones of this film. Holy cow. I mean, I shot down at the beach. It is contrast. You get quite a bit of it. I shot it down at the beach, full sunlight, and the sky that I got, the reflection off the water that I got was just absolutely stunning. I did a print 8x10, did a print 11x14. I'm having real difficulty focusing this stuff under a grain focuser.
Because there's no grain.
Literally, there's no grain.
Nice.
Kat at Film Plus gave me a little hint for focusing. She said, go outside the frame, do a tiny little scratch in the film, or not in the emulsion, but in the acetate, or, well, I guess this would be the polyester backing. Right. Just a tiny little scratch, focus on that, and then readjust your film from there. And this way, since you're focusing on the scratch, which is something that's actually there, you are seeing it. Right. So I'm definitely going to have to give that a try. If you get a chance, our good friends at the Film Photography Project, they stock a amazing line of Sfema films.
Yep, in 35mm, 120, and 620. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode. You can connect with us on Facebook. We're at Classic Camera Revival, or shoot us an email, classiccamerarevival@gmail.com. Have a good day, all.
До свидания, товарищ.
Да, камрад.
Rolling, check, check, check.
Check 1, 2.
Check 3.
Check 4.
Check, please.